right, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Friday, October 5, I believe. Is that correct? Did I say October? I meant to say December. I meant to say November 5. And we're looking at chapter 13. Are there any prayer requests this morning? Let's pray, shall we? Dear Lord, thank you so much for loving us. Again, thank you for giving us a beautiful but crisp day. Help us that we may prepare well for the Sabbath to come, in which we can end the slavery of our modern society and focus on our relationships with you and with our friends and family. We thank you that you've brought us through this week so far, and that we've had a good level of success, and we're grateful for that. And we are honored, amazed, inspired every minute of every day that we live, that we can, in fact, understand what love is. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. All right. My goodness, looks like we're a little out of focus on some of these things. Sure looks like it. I think we ended, was it here that we ended? We were partway through this particular one, I believe. And it ends on sildenafil. Anybody know what sildenafil, what the trade name for sildenafil is? A marketing name for sildenafil? It's Viagra. That's Viagra. So Viagra has a direct relationship to what's going on here. But not this mechanism, actually. A little different mechanism. And, okay, so, what happens here, ladies and gentlemen? Well, this is on overhead number 7 of chapter 13. We're looking at the G protein model, and let's see what's going on here. We see that we have a receptor that binds temporarily, allosterically as it were, to a 3-protein unit. That 3-protein unit is called what? It's nothing highly sophisticated. I mean, you've heard the term before. It's simply the G proteins. That's what there's no specialized name to it. So the G proteins, of course, consist of actually 4 items of interest. We see 3 protein items, and that is we see an alpha subunit, a beta subunit, and a gamma subunit. But a non-protein entity that's there and equally important is this GDP. When GDP is bound to that alpha subunit, does it indicate that that subunit is turned on or turned off? When the GDP is bound to the alpha subunit, does it indicate it's turned on or turned off? Off, thank you very much. That's correct. And what happens when an external signal lands on the receptor and conformationally sends that information through the lipid bilayer to this trimeric protein grouping? What happens to the GDP? Is everybody being bashful today, or I got bad breath, or he's just here but asleep, or here but asleep? Okay. So what goes on with the once that conformational information reaches that as alpha subunit, there is that information is transmitted to the alpha subunit, and the GDP is ejected, and a GTP replaces it. And at the moment that the GTP attaches to it, the 3 subunits break apart into a 2 subunit group and the alpha stimulatory alpha subunit, and that goes on to physically associate with the adenylate cyclase and turn it on, enhance its activity. It doesn't mean it just turns it on. There's adenylate cyclase activity at some low level all the time. It simply increases the rate. You know this because there are other inhibitory subunits that decrease the rate. So that alpha, that adenylate cyclase is manipulated by a couple of different processes, probably more than even what's listed here, but this is a simplified model.
So once the adenylate cyclase is turned on, it produces high levels of cyclic AMP. Now, we're now going to move on to this. What happens with the high levels of cyclic AMP? That cyclic AMP is known, of course, as what kind of messenger? What was the first messenger? Yeah, the signal, exactly right. Signal. Are there other second messengers in the cell? Say yes. Okay. Can anybody name one from what we've done before? Or not? No, not from previous experiences, because we haven't done it before here. IP3, and also perhaps even calcium, which we'll see in other things. Okay, so you got high levels of force, you got cyclic AMP. Now, what does this cyclic AMP apparently do? What's that R2C2? That R2C2 is given a couple of names. It's called cyclic AMP dependent protein kinase. Cyclic AMP dependent, there's a dash in there, CAMP dash dependent protein kinase. Now, I want you to note that how many apparent subunits does that enzyme have? Or does that molecule have? It has an R2 and a C2, so what's the total number of subunits that it has? 4. Yes, indeed. 4 subunits. Not surprisingly, the R's are called the regulatory subunits, and the C's are called the catalytic subunits. Isn't that convenient? The R's are called the what? Regulatory subunits, and the C's are called the catalytic subunits. And what you find here is when the R's and the C's are aggregated together in a single multi-subunit protein, R2C2, the catalytic units are turned off. So if you want to mention that the R's are the regulatory subunits and the C's are the catalytic subunits, and when the two are associated, the catalytic subunit is turned off, that would be a handy piece of information to recall in the future. Interestingly enough, the regulatory subunits bind cyclic AMP. And when they bind cyclic AMP, they release the dogs of war. Oh, no, not the dogs of war. They release the catalytic subunit. So you can see here where you have two regulatory subunits binding to 4 cyclic AMPs, and now you have the catalytic subunits physically no longer associated with the regulatory subunits, and now they are catalytically active. Since they are kinases, guess what they do? They add phosphate to stuff. Okay? And here's one of the things they add. Universal protein that it has a regulatory site that accepts this catalytic subunit and it phosphates it and turns it on here. And you can see here where you have this. Now look at that. Phosphoprotein phosphatase. By doggies. We've seen that before. Where have we seen phosphoprotein phosphatase before? Regulation of glycogen phosphorylase. Yes, in fact, that is the same enzyme. That's why they call it a phosphoprotein phosphatase, is that it's sort of ubiquitous. What does the word ubiquitous mean? Everywhere. McDonald's restaurants are ubiquitous. There you go. So, now, the interesting thing here is that, unfortunately, this diagram seems to indicate that whatever you phosphorylate, it turns on. Is that correct? You see a protein with a phosphate, and it says it's active. That is not always the case. You can phosphate things and turn them off. So make a note of that. All right, so then you have the cellular response. Now, obviously, if you have a mechanism to turn something on, you must have a mechanism to do what? Turn it off. How do you turn off the R2C2? Well, there is another enzyme called phosphodiesterase, and it attacks the cyclic region structure of the AMP opens it up, and you just have four AMP. So depending on the regulation of the external signal, the level of the adenylate cyclase normally, and the regulation of the phosphodiesterase, you get various levels of cyclic AMP, some of which interact with the R2C2, and then when they do that, they produce some sort of activity. Now, there's another name for R2C2, and it's called protein kinase A. Let's go on, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? Here is another one. This one is the phosphoinositide pathway, another G protein coupled second messenger system. The blank there, this is overhead number 8. IP3 and calcium. Calcium. And I think that's it for that. I don't think there's any more. So there are three blanks, four blanks. IP3, calcium ion. Third blank is second. Fourth blank is calmodulin. Calmodulin. All right. Well, we'll go through this. We'll recognize this. You begin to see some similarities previously. You see some sort of external signal land on a receptor. The conformational information is transferred through the lipid bilayer, interacts with the G-protein trimer. G-protein trimer separates into a dimer and a monomer. The GDP is ejected. The GTP is added. And therefore, you have the active alpha subunit of with the GDP there. This thing now acts on an enzyme called phospholipase C. Phospholipase C, which is a regulatory enzyme. Phospholipase C acts on PIP2. That's it. Inositol diphosphate. I think that's it. Pyroinositol phosphate, diphosphate. At any rate, it is a phospholipid. It has two fatty acid tails, but it has the inositol sugar that has phosphate on it as a head group. That phospholipase C acts on the PIP2 and produces IP3 and DAG. Diacylglycerol. Now, this diacylglycerol and the IP3 turn out to be messengers of some sort because the presence of DAG stimulates, notice the green dot right there, stimulates protein kinase C, PKC, to do stuff, and then the IP3 then stimulates other stuff. So we're going to follow IP3 first. IP3 then is released into the cytosol and acts as a second messenger. It interrelates with an IP3-gated calcium transport channel. This channel is in the endoplasmic reticulum. And allows calcium to move from the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum into the cytosol. Well, how does it do that? It does that because there is a concentration gradient between the calcium of the endoplasmic reticulum lumen and the cytosol. The rough rule of thumb is that the amount of calcium ion in the cytosol of a cell is about 1 micromolar. Write that down. The cytosol concentration of calcium ion is about 1 micromolar. And I use the term advisedly about. You'll see widely varying concentrations listed for the calcium ion concentration in the cytosol, but they're all low. In the micromolar range, the exact, whether it's a 1 or a 3 or a 7 or a 0.1 or a 0.2, they're all about 1 micromolar. In contrast, the concentration of calcium inside the endoplasmic reticulum lumen is about 1 millimolar. There's about 1,000 times different concentration. So the endoplasmic reticulum is about 1 millimolar. Again, I'm telling you based on the facts that you, based on your the author that you're reading, you may find different concentrations for that for the endoplasmic reticulum lumen. Suffice it to say, it's all highly concentrated relative to the cytosol. You'll also find that the outside of the cell is also about 1 millimolar in calcium ion concentration. About 1 millimolar in calcium ion concentration. So that you see that the interior or cytosol of the cell is fairly deficient in calcium ion. This is why calcium can be thought of as a second messenger within the cytosol. Because once it's released from the endoplasmic reticulum through this channel or other channels, or allowed to enter into the cell through other types of channels from the exterior of the cell, the local concentration of that calcium in the cytosol will rise and it can act as a second messenger. It's immediately either pumped out or pumped into the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum to maintain the relatively low level of calcium ion. You recall that from the synaptic cleft behavior. As you recall, voltage-gated calcium ion channels exist in the synaptic cleft on the presynaptic membrane. And as that voltage gate, as a voltage comes through from the action potential, the calcium ions, calcium channels open up and allow calcium to rush in, which triggers the fusion process, which allows then the neurotransmitter, thank you, to end up in the cleft. All right. But this occurs internally as well within the cell using a reserve of calcium ions in the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum. There's also a calcium reserve in the lumen of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, specifically in muscle tissue. And so voltages that come to the cell allow, in the muscle cell, calcium to come in, but also other signals allow calcium to come out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum as well. But we're talking here about the endoplasmic reticulum, which is much more, which is more generalized for most cells. Okay, so you got the AP3. It lands on the IP3-gated calcium transport channel. Calcium comes in, increases the concentration in the interior of the cell, and therefore it stimulates, for example, the protein kinase C. It also, which is also can be stimulated by this DAG. And the protein kinase C, not surprisingly, takes proteins, add phosphates to it, and you get some sort of calcium response, some sort of cellular response, pardon me. Now, other kinds of things that happen here is that this increased level of calcium acts on other kinases besides this IP3-gated calcium transport channel. Calcium doesn't act directly with it. The calcium, however, has a particular structure that it always uses to bind or always bound to. That structure is called CAM. Anybody remember what the CAM stands for? What does calcium bind to? Calmodulin. Yes, indeed. Calmodulin. So the CAM is abbreviated as calmodulin. Calmodulin is like a cassette or a repeatable structure that you find in a variety of locations anytime you want to capture calcium ions or capture calcium ions and use that capture as a signaling device. So calcium then binds to calmodulin, which is interacting with this kinase, which again, since it's a kinase, phosphorylates some sort of protein to provide some sort of cellular response. So here you see a wide variety of interactions that produce a wide variety of responses within the cell. Again, I just want to warn you that phosphating a protein doesn't always, quote, turn it on. It sometimes turns it off, and we'll see that a little later. Now, of course, if you have a mechanism that turns it on, you must have a mechanism to turn it off. How do you turn off the IP3 signal? Well, there's an enzyme called inositol polyphosphate 5-phosphatase, and it takes the 3 and makes it in a 2, and that kills the activity, just like that. How do you kill the calcium activity? The calcium activity is reduced because of the presence of the calcium pumps that are always operating. Calcium pumps pump it out of the interior of the cell, into the exterior, or pump it into the endoplasmic reticulum. I do not know of a mechanism. Well, I do not know what mechanism turns off the DAG. Just realize that all these many years, I've never asked that question to myself. What turns off the DAG? All right, we'll go ahead. Any questions about this? And we can go back. Any questions? Anybody? All right. Well, good. Now, then, what does this calmodulin look like? Well, this calmodulin ends up being a very symmetrical molecule that is composed entirely of alpha helices, and each half of the symmetry can capture up to two calcium ions. You see that right here. There is an alpha subunit, alpha helix, that connects two domains that are similar but in reverse stereochemistry. And the side chains of those helices provide binding sites for two calciums. And you can see here what they do. When they look at this in three dimensions, they end up having this hand. It's called, you've seen this with the zinc finger, or you've read about it. This is also the sort of the calcium finger, in which the structure here and the structure here have two alpha helices at basically 90 degrees to each other, and that a calcium ion can fit right in there, held by the charges of the side chains. So this is calmodulin. Its purpose is to capture calciums and to indicate the calcium presence to other proteins. And it has a particular and peculiar structure that you need to be able to recognize visually in the future. All right, so I think that's it for chapter 13. All right. Since we're here at this point, let's do some classroom management, shall we? Let's all talk. Let's see here. What are we planning on? What is happening? What's due in the next few days? Let's work. Let's take a look at homework, for example. The sapling homework, I believe I have assigned to be due on next Tuesday. All right. Then the key term quizzes, which are downloadable, they're due Thursday, which is the same day as the other set, although the other set will not be all five quizzes. All right. There will be a subset. It may be two, maybe three pages of about 10 definitions with 15 possible answers on three pages. That would be, I think, from 6 to 10, I believe. 6 to 10, 6 to 11, something like that. I did it in fairly concise, memorable pieces. So that's out. And then we have a reading guide, and it's also due when? I believe it's Monday, yeah. The reading guide is due Monday. So there's a lot going on, but at least I pushed it out of the same week that the test was in. Yes?
Chapter 5 still isn't uploading.
It isn't?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe it's just my computer. Did anybody else get it?
I did it yesterday.
You got it. I don't know why it's not working. I got all the other ones.
Wow. And so I uploaded a fresh one, and it still isn't doing it for you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, wow, I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. Anything else? Is there anything else that's hanging over your heads? There are the classes. Yes.
Because...
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Based on what I know of the content of the test, you must keep current on the metabolism pathways. If there are several questions on the standardized test that deal with specific details of metabolism quizzes. I know that the pentose phosphate pathway has some questions on it. I know glycolysis and citric acid cycle have questions, specific questions about the details of those pathways. Okay. You know, it's shockingly detailed in terms of, surprisingly detailed in terms of the specifics they ask about the metabolic pathway. Okay. You'll find that all biochemistry, ACS biochemistry tests have those pathways on it, but this particular one, the 2003, is particularly heavy in it. There are some, yes, and I can get those to you if you wish. I cannot upload them on Moodle. However, I can. They are retired, and the questions are retired, so they're pretty old. But I, you know, any practice is better than no practice at all. What do you think? Is that fine? Yes. Okay. So, would you mind taking the responsibility to email me that and request that, and I'll put that on my list. When I see it in my box, it'll put that on a list of things to do. And I'll see what I can do about getting it Monday or Wednesday of next week. Although next week is basically, I'm going to be about as busy as you guys are. If you can imagine how busy that is, I can't. It's very, very busy. Okay, so lots of things going on for me as well. And so, anything else? Yes? There is not been developed yet. And I'll have to do that this weekend, among everything else I do. Yes, I have. So I'll have to. I probably. You guys study Saturday night, don't you? Never? You don't? Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, we do. Of course. All we study Saturday night is biochemistry. That's right. We take a little flashlight to the movie and read while everybody else is enjoying. Anyway, so I'll probably be working on that Saturday night. Hopefully I can upload it Sunday for you. Maybe even sooner if things work out. Chapter 14, Introduction to Metabolism, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to continue moving right along. You'll find this extremely interesting. I hope you don't mind, but every once in a while I wander off the reservation here and begin talking about the impact on physiology. And because they're all what we're doing now, it has direct impact on what you're doing, how you're living right now. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. God spoke, and it happened. We're dealing with a God of almost infinite creativity. And the fact that when you look at what we are made up of, when you look at a protein and how inert and lifeless a protein is, and how inert and lifeless a sugar is, and how inert and lifeless a fat is, and how inert and lifeless phospholipids are. And we then are alive because of those molecules and are aware that we exist. It's all metabolism, ladies and gentlemen. How does it work? All right, so let's run through this. Go through. This is overhead number 2 of chapter 14, and I'm not sure I have figured out exactly where it ends. What's the last statement on this overhead? Okay, thank you very much. So there's a whole bunch of blanks here. The first blank is metabolic pathways, metabolic. The second blank is called catabolism. Anabolic, the third blank. Fourth blank is about halfway down in the page. Autotrophs. Next list is chemolithotrophs. Photoautotrophs. Heterotrophs. The next four blanks include the first blank of the four is obligate. Anaerobes. Anaerobes is the next blank. Facultative. Anaerobics. Obligate anaerobes. Obligates, the fourth line. Last two lines on this page are called, not surprisingly, macronutrients and micronutrients. Macronutrients and micronutrients. Macro and micro. All right, so what are metabolic pathways? Obviously, they're linked, as it says here. Individual reactions with the product of a previous reaction is reactant for subsequent reactions. We've been using that all along and memorizing it all along. Products and reactants are called metabolites. Catabolic pathways are always oxidative. Release of free energy. Catabolism is the breakdown of complex molecules into simpler ones with the subsequent free energy, release of free energy. Anabolic pathways, they're reductive. They require free energy. They're bond forming. All right. So, opposite of two above degradation. What has to happen here? These two are linked, but anabolic is not degradation. The opposite of two above is degradation. Anabolic is synthesis. Anabolic is synthesis. So when you're taking anabolic steroids, what's happening to your muscle structure? It's building it up. That's correct. So does anybody want to take a catabolic steroid? No. Nobody wants to take a catabolic steroid. All right. So, again, catabolic, release of free, you're breaking bonds, forming simpler bonds with simple molecules. Anabolic, it's synthesis, is reduction. Oxidation is breakdown, reduction is synthesis. All right, this is a little cell biology here. Autotrophs, where are we? Are we autotrophs? No, we're not. are we chemolithotrophs? Where do you find chemolithotrophs? Hydrothermal vents, that's absolutely correct. Photoautotrophs, where do you find photoautotrophs? Plants, certain bacteria, that's right. Heterotrophs, oxidation, energy from oxidation, reduced carbon compounds. I wonder, are we a heterotroph? Yes, we are. I never met a carbohydrate that I didn't like. My wife's got, we're having guests over for Sabbath dinner. You guys know Charles Neumann and John Neumann? You know what happened to their house? Got whacked by a lightning strike.
Can you find their address? I wanted to see their house.
Oh, you want to see their house? Oh! I thought, what? I can tell. You probably don't know where Tudor Road is, do you? Okay, here, you got to see. The house is not, the house is dead. It has every electrical device in it burned out. Okay, so here is the stop light in the middle of town, okay? There is a gas station right here. This is called Snow Road, right? Snow Road extends out this way. Here's Shawnee. This is Don's Automotive. Okay? The bridge is here. This is the bridge. Here's the St. Joe River. This is a stoplight downtown. And so here's Harding's. And here's this. And then there's a Nicky's. Is it Nicky's? That dive of a restaurant right there? Okay, at any rate, so Snow Road here. Here's Shawnee. You go to Bridgman this way. And then just past this is this road that does this. And that's called Tudor. You go up and down a hill or two, up and down a hill, and Tudor makes a big old wide curve and eventually comes back here and joins again, not oddly enough, with Snow Road. At this curve right here, there is it starts to go down a hill. There's a dip. You'll see a paved driveway in between trees here that goes off into like that, a paved driveway. Just before you get to that big curve, you turn into that driveway, and their house is sitting right here, and their property line is right here, and there's a tree. Actually, it's no longer a tree. It's some of the biggest toothpicks I've ever seen right there. And you can see where the lightning strike followed along to get their well. Look at their wellhead. Their wellhead, which is plastic, is broken. It just blew it apart. And then all electricity, all that voltage went in here, and they have not one electrical appliance. Even stuff that was turned off was blown up. The wall plugs themselves are no longer operational. They have to replace all of that. No, they won't even be there. I don't think so. Plus, No, they won't be weirded out. Especially, just say, Dr. Novak sent me, and that'll weird them out. But not me. All right, so how do we get on that subject anyway? I don't know. Carbohydrates. What? Guess for lunch. Oh, yeah, exactly. Start on carbohydrates. Potatoes. All right, well, let's go ahead, shall we? All right. Oh, my goodness. Now, we've seen this before, haven't we? Oh, my goodness. Here's all these micronutrients. Let's take a look at some of them. We, of course, have biotin. It's for carboxylation. Pantothenic acid, acyl transfer, cobalamin, alkylation, riboflavin, oxidation reduction, lipoic acid, acyl transfers, nicotinamide, oxidation reduction, that's niacin, peroxidine, amino acid group transfer, folic acid, one carbon group transfer, thiamine phosphate aldehyde, ascorbic acid, ascorbate hydroxylation, scurvy. Yay, scurvy dogs, and you have the fat-soluble vitamins here. So all these, all these things. I don't know what to do. Tell you about this. Hopefully, when I run across a vitamin, I will link it back to this table, so I won't have to have you memorize it, but you'll learn it by experience. Okay, learn it by experience. Nicotinamide, niacin, you can see structures right here. They are very similar. This is what you eat. This is what's in the body. And because of its resonance structures and so on, it can actually hold it can hold electrons and not hold electrons. Then you've got the various trace elements, major minerals and trace elements here. Can you be poisoned by an excess of selenium? Yes, you can. There's an area in China that has... What was it? A very high rate of heart attacks, I think it was, or something like strokes. And it turns out that there's a lot of selenium in the soil, and all the food that they had high levels of selenium, and it was affecting their health. So many of these I've asked you to memorize already. The fat-soluble vitamins are a problem. Lots of different diseases you see here, night blindness and hemorrhage if you don't have vitamin K and so on. What's the problem? Can you take an excess of water-soluble vitamins? The answer to that is no, because water-soluble vitamins simply are tinkled out if you take excess. So when you take excess vitamin C, the basically thing which you've got going is you have very expensive urine. That's basically it. If you're full of vitamin C already, any excess isn't going to help you much, despite what Linus Pauling says. However, taking excess of vitamin A, D, E, or K, they accumulate in the fat tissue, especially the liver, and you can cause liver toxicity if you have an excess of these, take an excess of these. And people have died from vitamin A poisoning. So especially children, especially susceptible to it when their parents try to feed them strange diets. All right. Hey there. Look at that. Common intermediates of metabolism. We've seen this before. Degradation. You can see that basically life is cycling through a very limited set of molecules. You get simple products. What would be these simple products? What do you think the simple products are? Ammonia. What's another simple product? Water. What's the other simple product? Carbon dioxide. So ammonia, carbon dioxide, and water. That's the simple products. All right. The other complex products that are within the biological realm are NADPH and ATP. You could probably include NADH, but for simplification, they left it off. So you can see here that as food products are degraded and produce the carbon dioxide, water, and ammonia, they also produce high energy intermediates or highly reduced intermediates such as NADPH and ATP. So ATP is high energy, NADPH is highly reduced. The NADH is used for NADPH is used for biosynthesis. So write that down if you would. NADPH is used for biosynthesis. NADPH is used for biosynthesis. You will say, but Dr. Novak, what about the NADH that we see in glycolysis, the electron transport system? That is used simply for electron transfer of high energy electrons. There is no biosynthesis. It's a part of the energy cycle, not a part of the synthesis cycle. So you make biosynthesis, and when you do stuff with it, when you make the carbohydrates, you make the proteins, you make the fats, you make the complex materials, you make DNA, and you make proteins, you then have the result. The NADPH is used up and needs to be regenerated. ATP is used up and needs to be regenerated. And you have the resulting complex metabolites, which are what you are right now. Okay. And so then they get back, they get brought back down through here. They get degraded, and you start the whole cycle all over again. All right, so you see here, what are the fates of the major food groups? We have proteins, polysaccharides, and lipids. How many calories per gram for proteins? How many calories per gram for carbohydrate? How many calories per gram for fat? Thank you very much. So what happens to proteins? You eat a big old, I got a Big Frank waiting for me for lunch. Since it's made out of soybean, there's a significant amount of protein in it. So what happens to that protein? I start chewing it. It lands in my stomach and gets what? Broken down. What happens primarily in the stomach is it gets denatured, which means it gets unfolded. All right? What if I... yeah. It's a testimony to the aggressive nature of your digestive tract that if you took a bite of a Big Frank, pretty big chunk of it, and you swallowed a whole, that you wouldn't see it when you defecated. At least I don't think. That means it's fairly aggressive. But there are still some things that you can see undigested. Is that correct? What? Corn. I don't know what it is about corn. I mean, really? Despite pH of 1 at 37 degrees for several hours and being attacked by all kinds of enzymes in the small intestine, yeah, you ain't touching me, guy. You know. So when you eat corn, you have to make sure you act much like a cow and chew the cud if you want to get that all chewed up. So break it all that corn all up. I don't know. Anyway, so proteins land in the stomach and do what? Get denatured, and then they land into the small intestine, and that's where they get broken down into what? Amino acids. And what's the biochemical fate of amino acids? Well, the problem is amino acids have a fairly toxic atom on it, and that's nitrogen. Nitrogen, when it's released, forms this ammonia and becomes basic, and your body doesn't like it. It's very bad on pH to have ammonia floating around in your cells. So that's immediately captured. You don't release ammonia. You release urea. It gets captured as urea. And what cycle captures the nitrogen as urea? The urea cycle. Exactly correct. All right, so then that gets expelled. There are some organisms, some complex mammals and animals, not mammals necessarily, and mammals that release ammonia directly, and those are called fish. Fish do that because they're surrounded by water and it's easily dissolvable. So they don't make urea, they just release the urea. The ammonia, pardon me. Polysaccharides get broken down into glucose, that gets brought into the cell. You go through glycolysis. End of glycolysis, of course, is what? Pyruvate. Pyruvate enters the citric acid cycle after releasing carbon dioxide, makes acetyl-CoA, CoA, which contains the vitamin pantothenate. Then cycles through here, the citric acid cycle releases carbon dioxide, produces NAD, FAD, and then you also get NADH, NADH, FADH. All these combine, enter into oxidative phosphorylation, which is also known as the electron transport system, ETS, and produces ATP and water if you have oxygen present. What happens to triglycerides? The fat. Oh, the fat. When you chew the fat with your friends, you don't gain weight. But when you chew an Oreo cookie while you're chewing the fat, you're liable to gain weight. The interior of that cookie is made up of basically sugar and shortening. Right? Sugar and shortening. So it lands in your stomach, doesn't do much. It lands in the duodenum and intestinal, small intestine, gets broken down to fatty acids and glycerol. That gets broken down further into pyruvate and acetyl-CoA. The glycerol goes to pyruvate. The fatty acids go to acetyl-CoA. They enter the citric acid cycle and make lots and lots of energy, assuming you have oxygen present. So your major muscle groups, when they're exercising, after you lose all of your stored carbohydrate, by the way, what's the stored carbohydrate stored as? Glycogen. Okay, the first 15 or 20 minutes of exercise uses up most glycogen that you have in your body, and the rest for major muscle groups uses what? Triglycerides or fat. This is why exercise, if you're trying to lose weight, exercise of your major muscle groups is always an important thing to do, to force the body to use the fats that are stored in your leg muscles. If you were to take my leg muscles, notice how not limber I am. If you take my leg muscles and you cut it across like a steak, okay, you'd see, because I'm an old man, that there are striations of fat all through the muscle tissue, like a what they call a well-marbled steak. Okay, well, that's what is a problem. You don't want to do that, and so. I still have quite a bit of fat there, you can see, but I have less fat than I had because I've lost some weight. Lost about 20 pounds over the last 6 months or so.
So when you eat, let's say, like positive carbs the following day,
right,
you're only benefiting yourself like for the first 15 minutes? Like you're only gaining energy?
Well, yeah, 15, 20 minutes, uh-huh. Seriously, yeah. So the pasta also, however, it quickly loads up the glycogen stores in your body, and the excess pasta then would be made into fat. And that's what would sustain you a little longer. Yeah. But have you seen an overweight marathon runner?
My car, I really Crystal clear blue water.